Well, good morning. First morning back. Doing the walk. Beautiful. Full moon. And, I'm wearing my heavy coat, and I think it's a little, there's some change in my pocket. Anyway, wearing my heavy coat, which is probably overkill right now, but I left my jacket at work foolishly. Oh, is that a dog? Great, that's all I need. Good thing I'm not riding my bike. Let me tell you, dogs have such a passion for bicycles and for chasing after and biting on them and biting on who's riding them. You know, you're not. Dogs aren't stupid. They know what makes that thing go. You know, they don't go after the tires. They go after your legs. Anyway, so we'll see how that goes. Anyway, talk at least a little bit about ShetlandFamily.org. I think she's always concerned because she thinks I'm going to do something crazy. I can't say much. I probably have a bit of a reputation for doing crazy things. And so, maybe I got a little short with her. It's like, I'm not going to quit my job and just go do this. Just go see how that's going to feed our family. And you go, Lisa, it's not meant to feed the family. It's meant to open up opportunities and situations. So everyone has to be straightforward about it. You know? We try to reform the world in a positive way. And it's difficult because the world is sliding downhill on many fronts, if not most of them. And you know, we need to we need to make wise decisions about how to do these things. I said, you know, I've always been a person that says what one or two changes that can be accomplished will really make a huge difference. And sometimes it's even useful if the powers that be aren't paying attention or for some reason don't see the ramifications of making a decision you know, I guess my classic example is non-compulsory school. You know, one idea that would shake the very core of the industrial school complex. I know that sounds weird because it's the military industrial complex, but there's just as much of one around school. You know, you would see so much sophisticated opposition to this sort of thing, you know. But also an idea that, frankly, strongly empowers families. You know, school would have to make a lot of changes. And I would, you know, and I would not advocate for cutting budgets for changing the funding scheme particularly, you know. That would be a really hard sell. You know, that would be the first thing people would be saying, well, if we make school non-compulsory and fewer children went to school, that said, you know, that would affect this person, and this person. You know, look at how many people would suffer. And you go, but look at how parents would be able to exercise more control just by nature, you know. And it wouldn't be just a decision of my children aren't going to school, you know, and then you can play the whole, then they will be dummies game, you know, which is political posturing. It's not true. So let's be honest. Schools don't make kids smart. Smart kids make schools look good. You know? And so you want smart kids. It's really funny, you know? You want that kid that comes from successful parents to be in your school. It goes off of another weird reality that I don't think anybody fully comprehends, except that more successful people probably expect more from their children and tend to get it. And schools like that. And schools are in the business of taking credit for things that really have nothing to do with school. You know, that's why principals, teachers, those who write such things, like being in what you would say call elite schools, you know, because they're going to look better. They're going to look like better educators. And you go, you know, it really isn't going to be a question of that per se. I said, the kid came from success. Their parents have put into their little hearts a success track. And trust me, your contribution to that is minimal. And it's mostly a societal thing. Like, say, for instance, in the United States, the private school model for upwardly mobile kids has pretty much gone away, mostly because people did figure out the fact that what school you go to really doesn't have an influence over your scholastic aptitude. Now it has great influence over the kind of contacts you make, networking possibilities, stuff like that, you know. Going to an elite private school, you know, is more of a resume builder than anything else. Whether you did really good at it or not, simply your presence there can pump up the old resume. You know. Institutions in general, not just schools, wrap themselves in convenient lies in order to, you know, in order to gain power and prestige and money. You know, all these things work together. You know, do they tend to get the best teachers? I really don't know. I really don't know if that's even part of the program. I don't know how these elite places even make those decisions. But what makes you an elite person? Is it the school you went to? Or was it the parents that got you into that school? And I think it's pretty fair to say that it has more to do with your background than with your grade point average. You know, George W. Bush, Bush 44, as they call him, 44th President of the United States, he was a, you know, I don't think we have any illusions of his grades. They weren't particularly good, you know. But that didn't matter. What mattered was he went to one of the big schools. Well, not a big school. He went to one of the elite schools. And in going to one of the elite schools, he gets that pedigree, you know, but it's mostly a result of what his parents desired for him, you know. They want him to be in a power flow, and that's how one tends to do it. At least in the United States. I don't know how it works in other countries. Probably in at least an analogous way. And that's not to denigrate that system. I mean, it's there. It works. You know, you can swear up and down that it's inappropriate and wrong and life shouldn't work that way. And you can cry about it all day long. But it's how these things work. You know. Not saying that you can't rise to those levels through merit, for instance. They're always looking for fresh blood, you know. these institutions can't survive and keep their reputations by simply letting rich kids in, because honestly that's kind of what happened to the nobility, to royalty, for instance. To a large extent, you know, nobody thinks much of it because they aren't better people particularly, you know. And, you know, there needs to be some merit way of getting into these, what you would consider to be a scholarship kid. Some scholarship kid. And they're going to get to participate in the lineage too, not to the level that, you know, the rich kids will. But, you know, it's called holding out hope, you know. The more you do that, the more likely your institution will survive, you know. If the gentry had been a little more cognizant of the need to reward merit with position more often, it probably would have survived better. You know, it would have been, yes, you know, there is an entry path to the gentry for people who aren't there. But they were pretty firm about it being a hereditary thing, and that only certain families were allowed to have that. And, you know, and to a large extent, that kind of spelled their doom. Anyway. So that's an interesting thing, because public school kind of feeds off of that on a much lower level, you know. There is the fight for the best kids, for the ones that will make your test scores look good, for academic and athletic ability, and the fact that we coddle such things. You know, no matter what their source, and let me tell you, their source rarely has anything to do with the excellence in teaching or, you know, the things that the school purports has done it. It said most of the, in fact, you can probably reliably say all, you know, lightning can strike on occasion. It says, but schools can't make lightning strike. It just kind of happens, too. Anyway, so, you know, it's important, I think, to serve as truth and not to be shy about reality, you know. Not to accept what's real now as if it can never change, but to say these are the circumstances that one faces, especially if one's going to go up against such things. And, you know, you go, is it important to fight these things? You know, are they fightable? So you have to understand, that's a family culture too. And in so far as the respect for family is general, as opposed to only certain families are, you know, are allowed to exercise this. You know, I said, it doesn't bother me that rich families can take advantage of their riches, and they can go to elite and amazing places and do amazing things that other people can't do. I said, that really doesn't bother me as much as the fact that those families have, you know, may be exempt from certain restrictions that are applied to other families, you know. So that's where it really kind of comes from, you know. In the days when, well, your child has to go to public school, but rich kids don't, you know. You can buy your way out of this system if you want to. And you go, that's what we would seek to get rid of, is the fact that there is some special privilege, you know, that, or no, not a privilege, a special exemption. And you go, there don't need to be special exemptions, there needs to be flat exemptions. And people can have them, and it doesn't need to be based on any criteria, you know, like, you know, there's always been the fight in homeschooling about what kind of credentialing parents should have if they're going to be allowed to homeschool. Should they have gone to a teacher, you know, can the children of teachers get out of the public schools, but other children cannot? And, I remember once upon a time here in the state of New Mexico in the United States, you had to be a college graduate in order to homeschool your children. You know, and that's kind of elitist, and I know it doesn't sound very elitist. At the time it was. There's only a handful of college graduates from anywhere. You know, all college graduates got to basically have a really good managerial sort of a job because there are so few of them, and it, you know, it was looked upon with great prestige. Not so anymore, but that's okay. Anyway, so. And then all of a sudden it changed to where all you had to do was be a high school graduate in order to homeschool your children. That rule still stands. I think to a large degree this stuff is becoming almost kind of passé, which is excellent. You can get an education in any number of places. You can get accepted certification, you know, graduation equivalency diploma, the GED, which was actually introduced. It was actually, I think it came up from kind of a military thing. The military wanted to raise standards of the people in the military. And they said, so all of them have to at least have graduated from high school. And you have to understand that for a long time, military service was considered a substitute for somebody who is not particularly academic. And so they had to do a compromise they went ahead and said, oh yes, we need everybody to be a college, be a high school graduate. But they also allowed for this graduation equivalency diploma, where you could go cram for a few weeks, take a test, and if you passed the test, it was considered equivalent to graduating from high school, you know. And the GED kind of broke out from its roots. In fact, the sad thing is it probably became a more respected credential than actually graduating from high school. They had watered down high school so much that kids who had graduated from high school couldn't pass the GED. That was a real shot in the arm for the GED. And now I think it has become something of the standard upon which everything else is done. Now most schools in most states, before you can graduate from them, you have to take a test, and you have to pass that test in order to graduate. And I'm reasonably sure, although it is never spoken, it is never said, and you'll never hear it. And if you ask the question, I don't know what will happen to you. But I think it's basically based on the GED test. Although, I have to say, it's probably a watered-down version of it. So, you know. And that's an interesting positive development for families. In that, it gives you so many choices. You know, used to be states, and you know, when things get codified in state law, it's very difficult to change. It really isn't logistically difficult to change. It's just difficult to get government, quote, leaders off of their ropes. To do something about it. That's really what ends up being the big issue. Are things like that. So, schooling tends to get less and less attention as it's found to be less and less relevant. As we take a look at it, we go, well, you know what? A lot of really successful people didn't follow the regular track. It's difficult to play that game of saying that we are the gatekeepers of success. You know, if you don't come and drink at our, you know, our fountain of knowledge, you can never do this and never do that. And I fall in the same trap. I'm bugging my son right now. He isn't doing very well in algebra. And I'm, wanting to put a little pressure on him. To say, you know. What are you gonna, you know? The grades are low now. What are you gonna do? Well, he's telling you something. So, I'm goddamn fast too, aren't I? The first guy who would also say that how many careers demand medical draft without I'm not even sure algebra has much to do with most of these innovations of our day. I mean, sure, the atom bomb requires to go to the science came from, not from the use of advanced, magnificent, brilliant scientific theory applied and answers found through it. Science actually arose to try to explain what had already been discovered. This is, I think I'm still right in saying that almost all advances, almost all discoveries are not the result of science. They are the result of other things, and science seeks to explain them after the fact, you know. I'm not saying that science isn't useful. I'm just saying that we probably put way too much stock in it, in its importance. It can open up avenues that we probably wouldn't have considered before. But honestly, you know, it says, when you get down to see some of the amazing things that goes on, you know, science isn't really terribly required to see it, you know. It said, most of our discoveries continue to be pretty obvious and don't require amazing leaps, you know. You go to a high school science class, it's mostly common sense, you know. Those things still hold true. And we talked about the scientific mind, it's like, well, I'm not sure at all. Scientific mind is required to make these things happen. Maybe necessary to explain these things. We tend to leave research and development up to people with PhDs in science fields. Says, but you know what? I don't think Thomas Edison could probably develop more stuff than anybody else. I don't think he was going to call himself a scientist. He was more of a brute force guy, more of a visionary, more somebody that saw stuff into their head, not terribly scientific at all, and said, I'm going to continue working at this until the end of my culture was just an exercise in absolute brute force, you know, continually trying this thing and that thing, you know. When you pass a current through a filament, it gets hot, you know. No scientist postulated that and then went out and proved it. Except it was just an observed thing. And they said, ooh, look, when you pass the current through, hey, look, it glows. So wouldn't it be cool if we could get that thing to glow for a long time? Because they said different materials will glow longer before they burn out. Says, is there a material that would last long enough to produce light sufficient to, you know, become a product, you know? It has much more to do with other things besides science. You know, not to say I'm not sitting here dishing science and saying that science is irrelevant. I think science is a great pursuit. I think it goes toward the understanding of how things work. It is not the act of making things work, particularly, at all. Although knowing how things work can inform the way we try to make things work, that's something along those lines. You know, but let's take this for instance. Was Einstein created at his school? Did his school create Einstein? The man who became. And the obvious answer is no. Why, how can you possibly say that? You know, I'm sure the school will take great credit for it. We produced Einstein. Well, let me tell you, how many more Einsteins did they put out? None. There's only been one. You know, what was Einstein? Let's be honest. He was a bolt of lightning. And a wonderful, you know, a wonderful, interesting one. And, you know, everybody wanted to take credit for it. Nazi Germany wanted to keep him. You know, he fled to the United States, which is more free. America made use of him. You know, anyway, so we, we have to be really careful, and I want to expand this a lot. Institutions tend to spin yarns, tell stories, and they are yarns. You know, most of them have very little truth to them. And they are supposed to, you know, it's mostly to save the institution, whether it's a school or government agency or a benevolent organization. Call them what you will. Because when it gets to the point to where this organization needs to, or feels the need to continue its existence, and I've always been one that says an institution should never outlast its purpose. It should have a stated purpose. And once the purpose is accomplished, you know, it should be disbanded so that the intelligence, the knowledge, the energy born from that effort can be used in others. you know, and it's interesting because, like, in thinking about Einstein, for instance, you know, his most amazing thing really came about very early in his life. And there was always the hope that from this amazing mind would come greater things. And when it kind of got down to it, you know, he was kind of a one-trick pony. And most of us are, let's be honest. Most of us have a life work. It's one thing. And, and once that one thing's accomplished, you know, you have all the prestige and all the cool stuff. I mean, we still know about Einstein today. Although, you might not know that Einstein lived through all of World War II. I don't remember if he died in the late 50s or the early 60s, 1960s. You know, everybody was always waiting and wondering when the next thing from Einstein was going to come. You know, he had the special theory of relativity, which shook up the science world, because you looked at everything differently. He's working on a general one, and never could quite figure that out. I think he was on the right track, of course. You know. I am a believer in the one grand theory that can be applied to nearly everything and explain nearly everything. We don't have that. I don't know if we're going to get it. I don't know what horrible things would happen if we got it. I don't know if God is guarding it tenaciously to keep us from it, or if we're even capable of having it at this point in our development. So, one of the reasons why we have a short lifespan is because of what's needed to inform. So this is a test. A bit of a school classroom perhaps. I don't like putting in those terms, but that's probably the ones you're most familiar with. And, it's God's test to proctor. You know, and if you are unhappy with the terms of the test, you know, that's really kind of immaterial. I think when you go to the Bible or to the Book of Mormon, I think it lays out reasonably clearly the criteria for passing the test. I know it's difficult for people who want there to be more, or don't want to be pushed too hard, or which is based on other criteria that didn't require them to change, for instance. And I don't think that's germane, you know. It doesn't matter what you want the test to be composed of. The test is the test. And everybody faces different circumstances. Sometimes, ones that God didn't formulate, you know? It's not, you know, it isn't a standardized test, particularly. It isn't, you know, it's not fair. When people try to say how fair God is, and you're going, I don't think it's useful to think that way. I don't think it's useful to even go there particularly. Your life is what your life is. You know, you can get upset that you were born with a handicap and other people weren't around you. You can look at other people and say, oh my gosh, what a horrible circumstance they have. And say, God is so unjust. And you go, I don't think it even enters into this particular calculation. It says, for everyone, you can make the choice of a kind of person you're going to be. One promise God has given that I bank on is that God isn't ever going to put you into a circumstance that, where you can't overcome, where you can't, you know, ultimately succeed, have victory, whatever, and not success as in money, but where you can pass the test with flying colors. How about that? Says earth life isn't just about the test. You know? It's also about your potential and using your potential, rising to it. And I don't know how much that enters into the ultimate, you know, equation of are you going to go to heaven or to hell? And now I don't think life works like that, but it's a convenient way of looking at reality for this kind of exploration. To say, hey, you know, this would be for some people, simply living on the earth and surviving for a number of years and then dying without having committed suicide first is probably a pretty good accomplishment. To where others is, you've got this incredible capacity, this incredible ability, and, you know, we'd like to see more and better out of you. You know, I've always kind of hoped I'm one of those second people. Sometimes I really do wonder if I'm just among the first. But you go ahead, you go out there and you try, you make the effort, and you go forward. And you basically see what happens. But to bring this kind of around full circle, you know, start off this whole thing talking about how institutions take credit for things that they might not have anything to do with. And I guess that's what we're talking about right here. The fact that people get sent, people of varying capacities, people of varying ability come here to Earth, and, you know, we have all kinds of different lives playing out. And, you know, it's easy it's easy to say, oh, well, that person was born with a silver spoon in their mouth, or this other person here had so many points against them, you know, so wonder they survived at all, if they even do. And it feeds into the whole kind of rating system. We all try to rate life or rate happiness or rate each other or whatever. And that's what informs, to a large extent, family culture, is what are those expectations. And should they be the same for everyone? Or should they be placed into the hands of each individual family to try to grok, to fare out for themselves. And and that's kind of what we're coming down to. I think that was what, you know, I gave a training to child care providers to talk about family culture, and it was an interesting one. I wasn't sure where these things were going to go. I wasn't sure where my mind was headed when I was doing these things. And the fact that I've decided to say that when you speak about the larger society, larger culture, for instance, it says you're just talking about something of an aggregate, or maybe even an average, of many family cultures. And I, for one, think that it's wise not to do aggregations on this thing. That as much leeway should be given to individual families to determine what's best for them, should be given, you know. And that should inform all things. And I think to a certain degree it does, except we just don't look at it in that fashion, I think. You know, we tend to look at societies, huge monstrous collections of people, and then the individual, the one person. It's convenient institutionally because, you know, it's very easy to show and very easy to see that an individual person can't take care of themselves, even if they have a good job and make a lot of money. It says they can't provide food for themselves and stuff like that. And you know, therefore arises the institutions, you know, that provide the means whereby individuals can have all these needs met. And it tends to ignore the thing that really does it, you know. Institutions take credit for the ability of families, you know. And insofar as you can trick families into thinking it's the institutions doing it, instead of just taking credit for it. Institutions grow powerful and can demand a lot of things. And, you know, and we give over so much to them because we've always been taught, hey, do you know how horrible life would be if we didn't have that institution or this institution or that or this or that or this? You have to understand, just like in that school, taking credit for that smart kid and saying, look at what we produce, just like that school saying, hey, look, there's Einstein, we produce that. And when you come back and you say, well, where's the next graduating class of Einsteins? And they kind of look at their shoes and go, well, and you realize that the institution didn't make Einstein. Einstein just happened to go to that school. He could have chosen to go somewhere else, and that other place might have been able to take the credit for such a man. Not saying that that school couldn't have provide some more opportunities that he wouldn't have gotten elsewhere. But to say, you know, be careful. Don't let institutions and systems rule the day. They have no right to it. Says, you know, not saying that we empower families solely with no regard at all for institutions and systems, but we need to try to put them in their proper place. That many of the social and cultural ills that we see today are the product of the disintegration of the family in favor of institutions. And that we need to reverse that trend. And government as a system can be used to do that. Because we know that, I think we've learned over time that institutions are somewhat hostile to families. Families get in the way of them having the kind of reach, the kind of power, the kind of influence that the institution by nature wants to have. And you don't want it to do that. You know, respect for families is a difficult thing because a family may decide not to do what you think they should do. And that's difficult, you know, when you're running a larger campaign, bigger issue. You know, you want families to behave a certain way, whether it's militantly to go out and march for something or to sign a petition or something like that. And you're much more interested in getting individual people to do it. You know, we can if we treat people as individuals, it's easier to sway an individual than it is a family who has, you know, more thoughtful common concerns. The real power of the family is its ability to be a real manifestation of all of the attributes that make people better. You know, to be more self-sacrificing for the needs of other people, to to you know, that's probably one of the biggest things it does, is it really seeks to say, you know, you need to work, you need to put forth some effort to the common good of a family. And it's visceral, you can see it. You know, it really has an active effect, where if you're doing this kind of thing for a country or for a state or even for a community, it doesn't necessarily, you know, it doesn't necessarily come, you know, you don't necessarily see it. It's hard to sustain that for the simple reason that, you know, it just doesn't, it just might not mean a lot to you, ultimately. Anyway, so you need to keep thinking about this, write about it. It's the most important thing, to write about these things. And see what may come. See what's authentic. See what'll work. And however, there's people out here, and I don't want to disturb them. It's getting on to morning. And I'm really home. So, all I have for today.